argue that he cannot be identical to the Grant estate, I'm from this, that mine cannot be identical to the Grant. This paper will offer arguments against an application of a posterior, against his application of a posterior necessity to the statement Kane is identical to the Grant estate. Briefly, Kripke claims that all true statements of scientific identity fall under the category of a posterior necessity. So the statement that mine is the Grant, if it is true, must be necessarily true. Kripke argues that it is possible to conceive of situations where the mental state is not accompanied by the brain state, for example, March and pain, and situations where the brain state is not accompanied by the mental state, and that, an example of that is phenomenal zombies. If we can imagine a world where one exists but the other doesn't, then mental states and brain states do not be identical. This is because the identity of the poles must be necessary. Therefore, the statement the mind is the brain cannot be a true statement. In order to properly argue against this, it will be necessary to give a thorough account of Kripke's notion of a posterior and accessible. After giving this account, I will suppose that his notion is accurate, arguing against his objection to the identity thesis. Now note that although I will be arguing that Kripke has not refuted the identity thesis, I will not be arguing that the identity thesis is correct. The purpose of this paper is more to explore Kripke's argument than to try to solve the problem of consciousness. In order to discuss a posterior necessity, it will be very useful to be clear about what Kripke meant by that and certain other terms. Kripke does not always use the terms that other philosophers use. So let's first look at the distinction he draws between a priori, a posteriori, and necessity and contingency. Often these words used interchangeably, that is, a priori with necessity and a posteriori with contingency. But Kripke argues that they shouldn't be. The reason that the term should not be used interchangeably is that a priori and a posteriori refer to how we come to know the truth of something, while necessity and contingency refer to how the truth would hold up under different conditions, that is, in other possible worlds. The former deals with epistemological considerations and the latter with metaphysical ones. As Kripke says, quote, "It's certainly a philosophical thesis and not a matter of obvious definitional equivalence, either that everything a priori is necessary or that everything necessary is a priori. Both concepts may be vague, that may be another problem. But at any rate, they are dealing with two different domains, two different areas, the epistemological and the metaphysical." End quote. Another distinction that plays a role in Kripke's argument is between accidental and essential properties. An accidental property is one that can be taken away from an object without changing what the object actually is. An accidental property is only contingently connected to the object. For example, being the president of the United States is an accidental property of George Bush. We could easily imagine a world where Bush did not become president without changing the country.
Sorry, it's very funny given the history of Mr. Bush's election.
An essential property is one that cannot be taken away from an object without changing the object. It is necessarily connected with the object. In order to give a decent example of an essential property, as Kripke takes in the view, it will be necessary to look at his notion of rigid designation. So, with respect to reference, Kripke introduces the concept of rigid designator. Something can be considered a rigid designator provided that it refers to the same object in all possible worlds in which the object exists. Something is a non-rigid or accidental designator if it can refer to different objects in different parts of the world.
Excuse me, could you write these strategic terms on the blackboard? I'm having difficulty.
Rigid designation?
Yeah, starting from where, you know, the a priori, the posteriori, and those things.
Okay. And with the exception of this one, generally the way that they're arranged would all fall together except this one, actually. So essential property and rigid designator are necessary to an object, what, in the case of curtains, gonna argue that there's a posterior lung necessity. So, okay, oh, where was I? So with respect to reference, Kripke introduces the concept of rigid designators. Something can be considered a rigid designator provided that it refers to the same object in all possible worlds where the object exists. Something is a non-rigid or accidental designator that can refer to two different objects in different possible worlds. These designators can be individual words, phrases, demonstratives, or variables, provided that they have a particular reference. Returning to the example given above, the phrase "the President of the United States" is a non-rigid designator. In this world, it refers to George Bush, but we can imagine a world, perhaps a nice one, where it referred to George Clooney. It does not have to refer to George Bush, and it's a contingent fact that it does that making it a nice set of property. It is a non-rigid designator of the object George Bush, and in this paper, the term object is used very broadly and really just means the reference. So nothing can just be. However, the name George Bush is a rigid designator, and Kripke argues that all proper names are rigid designators throughout the text. We cannot imagine a world where George Bush was someone other than himself. In fact, being George Bush is an essential property of George Bush. To put it in other words, the name George Bush, as we use it in this quote, cannot refer to someone other than the person George Bush in other possible worlds. Note, though, that we can talk about a possible world where George Bush's name is Saul Kripke. In this case, what we're doing is stipulating that the name Saul Kripke in that world is the same as the name George Bush in our world. They both have the same reference, namely the person that we call George Bush. However, if we were to imagine a world where Saul Kripke had the name George Bush, we'd no longer be talking about the person George Bush, but about the person Saul Kripke, and the rigid designator Saul Kripke. More will be said on rigid designation later in this paper, but first we must look at some issues surrounding possible world thought experiments. Generally, when we talk about a counterfactual situation, we are saying that it is possible or impossible for the world to have turned out in a certain way. What we seem to be doing is asking if we can conceive, without inconsistency, of a world where things are a particular way. For example, when we say it is possible for George Bush not to have been president, we are implying that we can consistently imagine a world where George Bush, that contains George Bush, and he is not the president in that world. Again, I'm nice. Kripke argues that possible worlds should not be given purely qualitatively. We stipulate things about particular objects within possible worlds, not just about their qualities or attributes. If we were to merely give possible worlds qualitatively, then we would have difficulty identifying objects across possible worlds. How would I know if a possible world contained George Bush if I did not stipulate that he was in it? Perhaps I would determine that the object was identical to George Bush if it shared a sufficient amount of characteristics with George Bush of this world. Yet it seems that we can imagine a possible world where Bush has none of the characteristics we would typically find him in this world. It is possible that he could have been born in Norway, became a philosopher, and married a man. Maybe. This seems to be a world where he exists, although we may not be able to identify him qualitatively. The notion of rigid designation relies on the fact that we do stipulate things about objects rather than just qualities within possible worlds. A rigid designator will designate the same object in all possible worlds, not the same quality. As Kripke states, quote, "The attempted notion deals with criteria of identity of particulars in terms of other particulars, not qualities. I can refer to the table before me and ask what might have happened to it under certain circumstances. I can also refer to its molecules. If, on the other hand, it is demanded that I describe each counterfactual situation purely qualitatively, then I can only ask whether a table of such and such color and so on would have had certain properties. Whether the table in question would be this table, table T, is moot, since all reference to objects as opposed to qualities has indeed disappeared." Note that he is not denying that qualities exist or that they are an important aspect of an object. However, he states, quote, "What I do deny is that a particular is nothing but a bundle of qualities, whatever that may mean," end quote. What must also be kept in mind is that we don't imagine a possible world and then see what it's like. We stipulate the conditions that we want to hold in this possible world and then determine whether it's really possible by looking for inconsistencies and contradictions. Kripke claims, "A possible world isn't a distant country that we are coming across or viewing through a telescope. A possible world is given by the descriptive conditions we associate with it." And again, possible worlds are stipulated, not discovered by powerful telescopes. With these clarifications in mind, we can now turn to an examination of Kripke's a posteriori necessity. Kripke's arguments about a posteriori necessity rely heavily on the nature of rigid designators and the distinction between an object and its qualitative properties. suppose we have two rigid designators, R1 and R2, and they have the same record. We can then say that R1 equals R2. For example, Clark Kent and Superman are rigid designators that refer to the same individual. In common discourse, however, we usually determine the reference through descriptive properties. For example, the mild-mannered reporter and the Man of Steel both refer to the same individual. In this case, the referent of D1 equals the referent of D2, where D1 and D2 are both qualitative properties. When R1 equals R2, there is an object that R1 and R2 refer to. That object is the same for both, and it is that object itself that is being referred to, not some property or quality of the object. When D1 equals D2, however, while both are referring to the same object, each is referring to a different qualitative property, or set of properties of the object. There is no necessary connection between D1 and D2, so some object X may realize D1 but not D2, while another may have both D1 and D2. However, the object itself can never be other than itself, thus R1 must always equal R2. Well, it seems that we could say it is possible that Clark Kent could have grown up without being Superman. This would be like saying Clark Kent could have grown up without being himself. What we actually mean when we say this is that Clark Kent could have grown up without having all of the abilities that we associate with Superman, faster than the speeding bullet, etc. However, Clark Kent is still Superman in virtue of the fact that Superman is nothing over and above the individual referred to by Clark Kent and vice versa, whether or not you know they are the same individual. Anything that happens to Superman must happen to Clark Kent and vice versa. Thus, if Clark Kent grew up without having superpowers, then so did Superman. The fact that Clark Kent and Superman both have the same reference is a fact that can only be known a posteriori from the point of view of citizens in Metropolis. No amount of thinking on the meaning of the terms will let one infer that the reference is the same. However, the fact that objectively speaking, Clark Kent is Superman is a necessary fact. As said above, to suppose that Clark Kent might not have been Superman, once it is established that he is in fact, is to suppose that Clark Kent might not have been himself. We can't consistently imagine a world where Clark Kent is not Superman. Thus, the identity of Clark Kent with Superman is an a posteriori necessity. The main focus of this paper is on Kirby's application of a posteriori necessity to statements of scientific identity. For example, the fact that water is H2O is a fact that we found out a posteriori. And is not something that we could have known without looking at the world. We generally consider this fact a contingent one. Water could have been something other than H2O, and it's just happenstance that it is actually H2O in our world. Kripke argues that this is not the case. Water is H2O out of necessity, and it couldn't have been otherwise because water is a rigid designator, and so it's H2O. Now, I recognize, and Kripke can as well, that there's many different types of water. When you say water is H2O, you are speaking loosely. Salt water would rigidly designate the chemical composition of salt water, and so on. So I don't see that as a problem for Kripke. Kripke states that most scientific identities involve the equivalence of two rigid designators, and if this is true, then the identity is necessary. To recap, the reason the identity is necessary rather than contingent is that in all possible worlds, rigid designator will designate the same thing. So if one rigid designator has the same reference as another rigid designator, then in all possible worlds, this equivalence must hold. Thus, it could not have been otherwise, and so it is a necessary identity. Now, because we must go out to the world and discover scientific identities, we know these truths through a posteriori considerations. The fact that water is H2O is thus a matter of a posteriori necessity. To help illustrate this, let us imagine a planet called Zion. And this is basically going to be Putnam's twin Earth argument. I just don't want all the stigmas associated with twin Earth. That would be. Zion is exactly like Earth, except that the substance they call water is actually made up of XYZ. Other than this fact, the substance is indistinguishable from our water. It has the same qualities and functions that Earth water has. Were you to visit Zion, you would not notice the difference. However, if you happen to get into a discussion of the chemical makeup, when the Zionian revealed that their water was made up of XYZ rather than H2O, you would say, that's not water. You and the Zionian are using the same word but referring to different things. When a person from Earth is speaking English, using the word water and using it correctly, they are referring to a substance composed of H2O molecules. The first caveman who pointed to the clear drinkable liquid that we now call water and distinguished it from other liquids such as sap, blood, etc., was referring to H2O, whether he knew it or not. When we try to imagine a world where water is something other than H2O, we can only do so by changing what we refer to when we say water. Another lesson that can be learned from the Zion example is that what we use to fix the reference of an object does not have to be a necessary property of that object. We fixed a reference of the word water as the clear drinkable liquid found in lakes, rivers, etc. However, we have just imagined a substance that has all these properties, but it's not water. Kirky illustrates this point with the example of defining the length of a meter. If we take a meter to be a length of stick S at time t0, then, quote, the definition properly interpreted does not say that the phrase 1 meter is to be synonymous, even when talking about contractual situations, with the phrase the length of S at t0, but rather that we have determined the reference of the phrase 1 meter by stipulating that 1 meter is to be a rigid designator of the length, which is in fact the length of S at t0, end quote. Often we will fix the reference of a term by a contingent property of the object. This is okay, so long as we recognize that the object, that it is the object itself and not the properties that fix the reference that the term rigidly designates. If we were to suppose that S had been shorter at t0, we would not say that the meter was shorter, but rather that S was shorter than 1 meter. Once the reference has been fixed, it becomes necessarily so. I'll now turn to some objections to Kripke. But to recap, if all scientific identities are a posterior or unnecessary truths, as Kripke has argued, then the state of pain is brain state X must be an a posterior or unnecessary truth, if it is a truth at all. If this is the case, then pain must be a rigid designator of brain state. But Kripke maintains that we can easily imagine a being having the same pain sensation we have with the brain state that we have. So again, Martian pain.
Could you read that down? I'm having difficulty keeping up with you.
Martian pain?
No.
So the idea behind that is a Martian doesn't have the same brain that we have, but it seems that we can imagine them having the same pain sensation that we have. So. Kirky maintains that we can easily imagine being the same pain sensation we have without having the brain state we have. He takes this view because he maintains that the only essential property of pain is the sensation itself. Anything that has the sensation of pain is actually in pain, whether or not they have the same type of brain state we have, which is why it is possible to imagine a being with a different neural structure that can experience pain. Thus, it seems that pain cannot be a rigid designator of a brain state, and thus the identity does not seem to hold. Pain and brain state can be correlated, but they can't be one and the same thing. Kripke argues that this is not like the case where we thought we could imagine water that was not H2O, but were mistaken. That happened because we fixed the reference of water by a contingent property and then thought that that property was all that was needed to pick out water in contractual situations. In the case of pain, Kripke claims that we fixed the reference by an essential property, namely the sensation. It is impossible to imagine having a sensation of pain without saying that that would actually be an instance of pain. Think about how you would react if you had the sensation of having your arm cut off, and someone said to you, oh, you're not in the right brain state, you can't be in pain. I mean, you'd think they were crazy. So, there's that. Now, because we fixed the reference of pain by an essential property, we cannot explain away our intuitions of pain. Our intuitions that pain can exist without the brain state and vice versa, in virtue of the fact that we are confusing contingent reference fixing properties with necessary properties, the way that we can with water not being H2O. The move that Kripke makes here has had a strong impact on philosophy of mind, and if you are persuaded by his notion of a posteriori necessity, then it may seem at first to be appealing. However, even if we assume that Kripke is right about a posteriori necessity, but this is a controversial assumption, of course. There are many objections that can be raised, and many ways to show that this move is inconsistent with all that has come before. First, it doesn't seem consistent to say that we can know what the word pain rigidly designates based purely on the concept or meaning of the word. Rigid designation is about reference. If we didn't know that water was H2O, we could claim that all it means for something to be water is that it is a clear, drinkable liquid found in lakes, etc. That does not mean that the word water fails to refer to H2O. Equivalently, Kripke can claim that all it means for something to be pain is that it has a sensation. But that does not mean that the word pain fails to refer to a brain state. The crux of the problem is that it seems that Kripke switches with pain from talking about reference to talking about meaning. While he's right to claim that all it means for something to be in pain is that it has the sensation of pain, it does not follow that this is the physical phenomenon that the word pain refers to. Water does not mean H2O, rather it refers to a collection of H2O molecules. In the same way, pain may not mean a brain state, but it could refer to one. Kripke would try to argue that it does not switch from reference to meaning with respect to pain. He would claim that all the word pain refers to is the sensation. What he doesn't acknowledge is that we do not yet have a physical explanation for what for the sensation. That is, we do not know a posteriori what a sensation actually is, we just know what it's left. In order to illustrate a point about rigid designation, Kripke gives an example that shows the necessity of cats being animals. He states, quote, "We could have discovered that the actual cats we have are demons. Once we have discovered, however, that they are not, it is part of their very nature that when we describe a counterfactual world in which there are such demons around, we must say that the demons would not be cats. It would be a world containing demons masquerading as cats, given that cats are in fact animals, any cat-like being, which is not an animal. In the actual world or a counterfactual one, is not a cat." Kripke is claiming that it may seem like we can imagine something about an object or phenomenon right up until we know what the object or phenomenon actually is. Once we understand the true physical facts about the object, we will know what is and is not possible about the object. To imagine about the object, I guess. As such, it seems that until we have a full explanation of what it is to be a sensation, beyond just what feel it, we do not know whether or not things we imagine about pain are real possibilities, even if it does rigidly designate the sensation. I'm running short on time, so let's skip a bit. Kripke has a line of defense, and he would remind us that he would always say that anything has the sensation of pain would be in pain. Granting this last point, it can still be shown that Kripke has not successfully argued that pain cannot be a brain state. Suppose that we had solved the problem of consciousness, and it turned out that the sensation of pain was merely a brain state. Forget for a moment that Kripke has claimed this is impossible. This identity would be necessary, so our intuitions about Marshall King would be false. How could this be, though? As Kripke points out, it seems entirely possible to imagine that there is at least some forms of life, different from ours, which would have the same reactions to being hurt or damaged that we would have. This is something that I agree with. What I deny is that they could have the sensation we have when we're hurt. It seems to me that Kripke would agree that pain behavior is a contingent property of being in pain, because in different cultures or even different circumstances, pain behavior is quite different. If the sensation of pain were to turn out to be a brain one, then our intuitions about Martian pain could be explained thus. We are imagining them having pain behavior, but given our new understanding of what a sensation is physically, we would have to acknowledge that it is impossible for them to have the exact sensation that we have when we are in pain. They may have an unpleasant sensation, but it would most likely be one that we could not recognize because it would not come from a neural structure like ours. Our intuitions of phenomenal zombies could also be explained away if the sensation is the brain. This case is even easier. If pain is a brain event, then to imagine being molecule for molecule identical to the one that I'm in pain, but without having pain, is to imagine something that both does and does not have pain at the same time and in the same respect. Once we have identified pain with the brain state, we cannot then separate them because there is only one thing. Kripke's a posteriori necessity requires that if pain is a brain state, then we cannot imagine Martian pain or phenomenal zombies. However, he claims that it seems impossible for the consequent to be true. That is, it does not seem possible to explain away our intuitions that we can imagine Martian pain, etc. Therefore, he concludes, it does not seem possible for pain to be a brain state or school. So it does not seem possible for the identity theory to be true. I have tried to show a way in which it is possible to explain away our intuitions about Martian pain and phenomenal zombies. Namely, we can do so if we suppose that the identity theory is true. Therefore, what we can imagine about zombies and Martians seems to be dependent on how the world turns out, just as it was for what we can imagine with water. This does not say that the identity theory is true, only that Kripke has not shown it cannot be. As a final note here, it may be suggested that I am begging the question when I assume the identity theory is true. I don't think that I am. What I am instead doing is showing that Kripke only looked at one side of the problem. In order to argue that we could imagine phenomenal zombies or Martian pain, Kripke had to separate pain from the brain state. In doing this, he must assume that the identity theory is false. What he's shown is that if the identity theory is false, then we can imagine Martian pain. What I have shown is that if the identity theory is true, then we cannot consistently imagine Martian pain. So what we can conclude is that we must wait until the identity theory is determined to be true or false by the world before we can know what we can really imagine about Martian and zombies. In conclusion, I'm happy about it. What I have tried to show here is that when we accept Kripke's notion of a posteriori necessity, we still have no reason to accept what he says about pain. Kripke tried to show that pain could not be identified with the brain state because such an identity would only be contingent. I have argued that such an identity, if it existed, would be necessary in accordance with his ideas of a posteriori necessity. So the only thing Kripke has succeeded in showing us is that if the identity theory were true, then only things with our neural structure could feel pain. and nothing with our neural structure properly working could feel or feel pain under appropriate conditions, so this being in a particular brain state. That is, this is in and of itself an interesting point, but it does not refute identity theory. However, if the identity theory were to turn out to be true, we may be inclined to change the use of our word pain to refer to states of other beings that are relevantly similar to our own pain states. In such a case, though, the relevant similarities would have to be pain behaviors rather than pain sensations. In the same way that water can be used as a blanket term for watery stuff, suppose here that we opened up treasures with science, surely the layman would call XYZ water. The word pain would be used as a blanket term for exhibiting pain behavior based on some sort of sensation. The most important thing to note here is that it would require a change in our usage of the term pain, in particular an expansion of the record. As it stands now, according to Kripke, our word pain refers to the sensation that we have when we are in pain. Given the assumed correctness of identity theory, no other beings can have that pain. If this change in the use of the word occurred, then just as we have varying types of water, we would in this case have varying types of pain. We would identify pain by the contingent behavior, just as we would identify water by the contingent properties. But each type of pain, Martian pain, reptile pain, human pain, etc., would rigidly designate the particular sensation associated with it, and whatever physically the sensation actually is. For example, in humans, it would be brain state. So while Kripke leads us to a conclusion that makes us nervous, if the identity theory is true, no other type of being can feel pain, we must remember that he is talking about our concept of pain. There is nothing inconsistent about the idea that other beings could have a particular sensation they would call pain and react to the way that we react to pain without it actually being our pain. And there seems to be nothing overly problematic with the expansion of the reference of our term pain to include sensations of these beings.
I have two different ones. The first easier one, why is he choosing the sensation of pain rather than the sensations of color that we have, or the sensations of smell or touch?
Nothing hinges on it. It's just that pain is the standard example. Nothing.
Because there is, I mean, pain is a sensation, and there's a particular part of the brain where it's received just like other sensations.
Yeah, but pain is just the stock example. He could have done the exact same thing with any other sensation.
Are you sure?
Oh, no, sorry. Maybe I'm speaking too fast. I'm not positive. But I think the idea is that he could.
Yeah.
For him.
At the beginning, the problem of other minds there.
I'm not going to have any objections about the problem of consciousness, because that's not the purpose of my paper.
Now, the other question, it has to do with this a priori necessity.
A
posteriori necessity. I don't know what that's. I understand what he means is that you discovered that there's a necessary connection. But you only discover the necessary connection. Because experimentally you find out that water has the constituents of hydrogen and oxygen. But then you discover that there is a necessary connection by your experiments, and it becomes a priori, given that you have
It doesn't become a priori, though. Because
it's not that you discovered it a priori, it's that and you're not, but when you realize what the nature of water is and the nature of hydrogen and oxygen and what happens that when they combine, then you realize then this is a priori, and then you can continue. I don't see that the discovery of the necessary thing, but you don't know that it's necessary until you're able to do that.
Yes, but it never becomes a priori because you can't, no amount of thinking on the meaning of the word water, or you can't come to the discovery that water is H2O by thinking of the word water, right?
No. I'm just thinking of the Kantian view of synthetic a priori.
Okay.
I think Kripke is attacking Kant's view that if a view is if there's a necessary connection, then it has to be a priori. I'm not saying that it's analytic. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about the synthetic a priori.
Okay. I'm not familiar with that. Would you like to talk about it after? Because we're running short on time.
Okay.
More questions. Okay. Joel, first.
Could you make some kind of argument that pain, maybe you were talking about this, but pain is something more akin to tables and chairs where you don't have a rigid designation, such as water, right? You have more of that. I mean, tables and chairs, it's just description.
Yeah.
Right? So when you talk about pain, the results, not a rigid designator like water.
Perhaps, but I mean, Kirby is quite clear that he thinks that pain is a rigid designator. It rigidly designates the sensation. Does that, but I see what you're getting at, and he doesn't make that argument, but he might be able to.
Yeah, I don't mind, because I don't think any neuroscientist today would really think that pain is something that can be grounded in some, that rather than specific neurological structure.
Okay,
yeah,
no, but excuse me, Melzack certainly does. Ronald Melzack. Yeah, he's a great expert on pain. He has a pain clinic up in Montreal.
It seems to me that you might be able to make just friendly talk. Your closing remarks about the acceptability of continuing to use the English word pain for what might, in some more refined sense, be species-specific varieties of pain. You might be able to link that up. In a fairly fruitful way to your remarks about water earlier on. Say, look, this is what ought to fall out of his cheek. Mm-hmm. If he does think about water, at least the terms associated with water in the way that you sketched, anyway, well, sure, strictly speaking, there's salt water, and then even, different concentrations of salt water, and then there's water, fresh water, but of course, fresh water you find in lakes and streams, to our streams, especially those, is certainly not just H2O, there's lots of stuff in there. The ordinary English word, water, is very permissive. It's not like anybody thinks that what Kripke's done has told us that we should stop saying things like, oh, you're drinking water, or even though you're drinking many, many other things besides H2O when you drink that. So that might, provide a model for what you can say. What might follow if your views on pain subsequently.
Yeah.
Sure, we'll get some sort of scientific refinements of precise indications of pain, but it would still be perfectly respectable to, there'll be some sense of whatever we have to do with the semantics to make it come out right. It will remain as true on your picture to say Martians are in pain as it is to say you're drinking water.
Yeah.
That's as true as it needs to be.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, I just added the stuff, the very last stuff that I said was added quite recently, so I haven't fully worked out how that and any implications for this.
Right, it's just going to be a way to pull it together.
Yeah. Anything else?
Just like a clarificatory question, so just to make sure that I'm straight what you're trying to say. So Kripke argues that the only essential property of pain is the sensation of pain,
mm-hmm.
the phenomenal sensation.
Yeah.
And then what you're trying to say is that in the case that the identity theory is true, a brain state would also be essential?
It's not that the brain state would also be essential, it's that the brain state would be the sensation. So if the sensation is essential, then the brain state is essential because it is the sensation. It was pointed out to me recently that the view of identity theory that comes out of Kripke, the one that get forced into, is a very odd view and not in line with most identity theorists because you have this strict, there is only one thing. It's not that the sensation is another property of a brain state or anything like that. It's this very, very tightly bound identity.
So would the identity theorist want to say that the sensation is not an essential property of pain?
No, I wouldn't think so. I don't think anyone would deny
so are
the sensation is not an essential property. Well, I mean, maybe people would I don't know how that would go.
Because there seems to be like a clear conceptual distinction between the two.
Between a sensation and a brain state?
Yeah.
This is getting into the problems with identity theory. We could talk about that a lot.
I'll stay over to Andy's kitchen for lunch and open my appointment.
Oh, great.
Jeff. Can you tell people that you'll be the leader in case they don't know where it is?
Yeah, I'll be the leader. I think that's why I'm here.
Don't talk about it. I want to quiet it down so that it's not going to be.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we want to grow this. I'm going to get all the time.
Yeah, this is